time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday the 18th of June 2011. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 to 12, with the interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7pm and Thursdays at 12:30pm. On Saturday the 18th of June, Jan Scott talked to Kay Peterson about the sculpture on the golf exhibition controversy, and she spoke to Sharon Al-Bakri, who has an idea to have wind-up radios in every Waiheke home.
And it's now my pleasure to say hello to Kay Peterson. Welcome, Kay. Now, Kay, you are the chair of the committee that organises Sculpture on the Golf, is that right?
That's right, the chairman of Headland Sculpture on the Golf, yes. Right.
How long have you been in that position?
I've been on the committee now for 10 years. Seems a long time, but I've been chairman for the last two events, so that's 4 years.
Right, okay. And how did you come to be involved with it all?
Oh, well, it was through my involvement with the Waiheke Community Art Gallery. I was on the gallery committee, and when the Headland group was formed, three gallery committee members were appointed to their partnership, and I was one of those three.
Oh, right, okay. You've obviously got an interest in art.
Oh, yes, yes, long-standing interest in art.
Right. Are you an artist yourself?
No, unfortunately not. I just admire the work of others.
Right. So you've been a sponsor of art in the past?
Yes, yes we have.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, the Headland Sculpture in the Gulf, was that an initiative of the art gallery or did it come from somewhere else?
Yes, we've always called it an initiative of the Waiheke Community Art Gallery. It actually arose from an offer by three founding benefactors to mount an outdoor sculpture exhibition on a large scale. And when those people spoke to the then chairman of the gallery, a partnership was put together really between the gallery and those three founding benefactors. So they took their place on the committee and did great work for three events. Then when they left the event, their place was taken by other people, independent people from the community, really mostly people with professional skills that the event needed for success.
Right. Is this, it sort of happened because the event got bigger than you expected?
I think we always hoped that it would get it as big as it has, but certainly it has grown over those 10 years, and it's always been for that 10 years a partnership between the gallery and the Headland Committee. Unfortunately, that structure is not really adequate to carry it into the future for both the gallery and for Headland.
And that's where the difficulties have arisen.
Yes, it's the difference in approach to that that leads us to the current situation.
Okay, so are you suggesting that the Headlands group becomes a separate group to the art gallery?
Yes, I think our position is that there needs to be a separate legal entity that is in control of its own destiny, but one that maintains a very strong relationship with the gallery, both from an input point of view and also from a sharing of any financial reward that comes from the exhibition.
Right. So at the moment, the way it's set up, any financial rewards go to the gallery rather than the next?
No. The way that it's been set up, which has been, it's quite a satisfactory arrangement, I think, for all parties, has been that the Headland event must run at break even, so we have to cover all our operating costs, and of course those are quite high, so it is regarded as a high-risk event. And then if works are sold, and bearing in mind that selling works is not our primary objective, but if works are sold, then the commissions from those sales are split equally between the gallery to use for general funds in the community, the art community of Waiheke, and the other 50% stays in the retained earnings of Headland to build a continuous funding for the next event.
So does that mean that the artists themselves don't get anything?
Oh, no. The artists get their the value for their work before the commissions are paid.
Oh, yes. That's fair enough. So they get reimbursed for their expenses, as it were.
Yes, well, the Headland budget has always included a lot of support for exhibiting artists. We pay a significant amount towards the cost of freight, travel, accommodation, general expenses. So it's, apart from that, we pay each grant artist a grant. So each artist, since the first event, has been given a grant towards the cost of making their work. So the total artist support cost from our total budget is quite high.
Yes, it would be. Yeah, and some of those exhibits would be hugely expensive to transport, I would think.
Oh, they certainly are. And not only that, but just the logistics and the sheer practical difficulties of doing it. Also the actual installation, because of course we are working on a council walkway. In many instances we rely on the generous cooperation of the neighbouring landowner to actually install the work over their property. So it does take a tremendous amount of coordination and goodwill from a whole lot of people.
Mm. And it also takes a lot of sponsorship. You've no doubt got some very generous sponsors out there.
We do have. Not only sponsors, we have granting bodies who give us grants from public organisations and some private. Also, we have a wonderful friends and patrons group, a very significant group of people who give us financial assistance. And many of those, of course, are also volunteers, and some, of course, are also on the organising committee. I don't think we can underestimate the work that that organising committee does. They work for 2 years for each event. And they do put in a huge number of hours and their professional expertise to make this all happen.
Right. Now, when you're applying for funds from bodies, do you do that under the umbrella of the gallery?
No, the applications go in the name of Headland Sculpture on the Gulf. They're quite separate to any applications that the gallery might make, even if it's to the same organisation.
So are you a legal entity in your own right at the moment?
No, not at the moment. And that's where the difficulties start. It's not a tidy business operation not to be a separate legal identity.
Right. So what sort of structure are you suggesting?
Oh, well, the structure that has always been top of mind for Headland at some time has been a charitable trust. And there are lots of advantages for a charitable trust, but the most obvious one is that the trust is set up with a trust deed, and in that trust deed the terms are set down, literally cast in stone, so that everyone has certainty over what the future holds.
Right. So you'd be setting yourself up as a charitable organisation?
Yes, it would be a registered charitable trust.
Right, and that would come under the criteria for the Charities Commission.
Yes, right. Which the gallery is, of course, at the moment as well.
Yes. So their structure at present, is that a charitable organisation?
Yes, they are a registered charity, but they're an incorporated society, so it's a slightly different organisation to a trust. And for the work that the gallery do, an incorporated society is a very adequate model to use for that.
So what do you see as the advantages for a trust your situation?
Well, the first one is the fact that it is a separate legal entity. The second one is the permanence of the trust deed. One of the difficulties, if you like, of operating as Headlanders at the moment is the gallery committee are elected on an annual basis. And with the changes of committee people, you do tend over time to lose the historic knowledge and the continuity. Headland needs to be able to guarantee its objectives and purpose into the future without the prospect that can be changed. So that's a very important part to us. The other thing that a trust allows us to do is to have a system whereby, for instance, the volunteers and the friends and patrons and other interested groups of people, if that was the case, can elect the trustees. Gives us direct accountability and communication with our real supporters.
Right.
And we value that very highly, because without them and without their contribution, we simply couldn't do the job that we do. So we see a trust to be set up with, say, two trustees appointed by the gallery committee, which keeps our good links with them, and three trustees elected by the community. And we see that as being a very stable and very egalitarian sort of a system to have.
Indeed. You're listening to Island Life, and we're talking to Kay Peterson, who's the chair of the committee that organises the headland sculpture on the Gulf. How many on the committee at the moment, Kay?
The Headland Committee at the moment is quite small. There are six people on it, the three gallery representatives and three independent representatives. That normally happens after an event. Some people retire because they feel as if they've given their bit, and that's great. And then we undertake to find people who want to fill those positions. It usually takes us a little while to do that because we are looking for a fairly unique combination. We need people with the right professional skills. The time, to be available for quite a large number of hours over the two-year period. But also that X factor, the passion and the commitment to take on a high-risk event and put their name out there in the public arena and actually make sure that it all happens successfully.
Right. So the proposal in changing to a trust... I think you mentioned five people on that committee?
Yes.
So you're reducing the number of people?
Well, we're talking about five. If, in fact, when the trust was settled, it needed or people wanted it to be more than five, it could be more than five. But it's not intended that only those five people would be responsible for running the event. There would also be people who were paid employees and other people probably seconded to an organising committee who would help. And we've always done that because we've had to have, for instance, a volunteer coordinator, a sponsorship coordinator. So, you know, there are a lot of media is another big one. So we always have had to second people to assist us with their special skills.
Yes, that's right. I think some people sort of have the idea that you've got to be on the committee to be involved in a thing like that.
No, but, far from that.
Yes, you don't want to get too unwieldy in the number of people you've got on a committee, otherwise it gets out of hand, doesn't it?
Yes. Well, and another thing, of course, is that many of us are not always on the island. Some people are commuters and spend a number of, bit of time in the city. Other people have commitments in other places. So you do have to have enough people so that you always have, the right number of people here to do the work in hand. But we've always managed, and I think with an organisation which is largely voluntary, there's always a lot of give and take in that regard. Mm. And people accept that others are not always available. And, it's just a very much a win-win situation where you all help each other.
Mm, that's good. Mm. And also I think there are some people out there, or quite a lot of people, who can't bear the thought of being on a committee but want to get involved and help with something. And it's good to know that you don't have to be on a committee to help out with something like Sculpture on the Gulf.
Exactly, yes. But you're quite right. Being on a committee does bring its own challenges. And I think this is a good example at the moment of some of the difficulties of being involved in committee work, because you do have to carry the hearts and minds of a lot of people. And at the moment, the gallery committee really, or the gallery itself and the membership, is facing probably one of the biggest decisions it's ever had to make. And it's not an easy position to be in. And particularly because we're all very fond of not just the gallery, but the activities that go on around it and the contribution that all of those people make to island life in general. So it's not an easy position to be in to have two opposing points of view.
Mm, that's right. And hopefully that will be resolved amicably, and both sides will end up having a good organisation to carry forward into the future.
Yes, we'd like to think there was a win-win in all of this, because the basic idea is that if Headland is strong and fulfils its potential, and there's every indication that that would be the case, then the gallery has to benefit from that as well. So when Headland does well, the gallery will do well. If Headland doesn't have a secure structure or is subject to unilateral change, then the prospect for the gallery naturally dims. It's just a consequence of that.
Mm. Have you had any pressure from outside to move in this direction?
Yes, we have. A number of people have identified that the current structure is not really adequate. As long ago as 2004, The gallery obtained significant legal advice as to a possible structure for the future. So really what we're doing at the moment is just fulfilling what was begun in 2004.
Right, so you're following up on that advice?
Yes, we are. And I think it's really timely now. I think with an event which is held every 2 years, and again with volunteers, you tend to want to put off some of those hard decisions. But I think we've got to the stage now where we can't put it off any longer.
And I guess in those 4 years you've looked at a number of different options.
Yes, we have looked at different options. But the trust always comes out on top. It's largely the permanence and the security of a trust deed, the fact that we can have a good electoral college, people voting for the trustees, so we maintain that critical public interest in it. I think that's really important. Also, within that structure, we can enshrine, cast in stone, whatever, the concept of return of funding to the gallery for the future. And that's a really important feature for gallery members and gallery supporters, because they want to know that the gallery is going to have that assistance. So the fact that the trust structure enables us to do that is very good as well. And again, it becomes a matter of certainty.
Yes, that's right. excuse me. Am I right in thinking that at the moment the members of the Headland on the Gulf group are also members by virtue of their membership of the art gallery?
Actually, no. It is a little bit ironic. The members of Headland, if you like, the friends and patrons of Headland who support us very generously financially, don't, because of that contribution, automatically become members of the gallery. For anyone to be a member of the gallery, they need to pay a separate subscription.
So anybody who's a member of the gallery, conversely, isn't necessarily a member of the Headland.
They can be a friend and patron if they become a friend and patron by payment, or they can become a member simply by being a volunteer. So we, for instance, had in the last event in February this year 170 volunteers working on the track over that 3-week period, a huge contribution from those people. Under our suggestion, their commitment and contribution in time is significant enough for us to say that entitles you to be a member and to have a vote for trustees. And we feel very comfortable that their contribution is recognised in that tangible fashion.
So how is the committee appointed at the moment?
The Headland Committee? Three members are appointed by the Gallery Committee, and the others are appointed within the Headland Committee, identified, chosen, talked to. If they agree, then they become a part of the committee. It's a relatively loose arrangement, and it doesn't have any electoral college as such as a trust would have.
Right. So there's no accountability back to the people of Waiheke?
No, it's one of the weaknesses of the current situation, because in a similar way, we don't report financially back to the rest of the Waiheke community either, because our financial reports get swallowed up, if you like, within the consolidated reports of the gallery. And we would much rather that those things are quite transparent, accountable, and a more direct relationship with the community of Waiheke.
Right, because I guess that's something that people will be thinking, that you are accountable back to the community through the gallery.
Yes, but unfortunately that does blur the messages and the contact that we have. We don't find that adequate.
Okay, and I guess there might be some concern from people who are giving you significant donations and input as to your legal structure.
Well, actually, most people have been so supportive and so passionate about the event that not many of them actually raise those concerns. There have been some, it's true to say, but generally speaking, people have put their passion and support first, and those queries have not been top of their mind. But they are definitely there. I mean, and there are issues with any normal commercial business. This one, however, is high risk. I mean, we're talking about a significant turnover. In fact, it has become the single biggest event now on Waiheke Island. Last event attracted 34,000 people. And we have to remember that probably 30,000 of those are not island residents. So we are bringing a lot of people onto the island. It's not just a Waiheke event any longer. It's not even just an Auckland regional event. It's truly national and international. Now, to have the security into the future to be able to offer long-term sponsorship deals with people, we need to know that the business plan is secured over that long period of time. And for that reason, a trust offers a lot. It's a lot more, how shall I say it? It's a much easier package to sell to potential sponsors and granting bodies. Trust is a concept that's very readily understood, particularly a charitable trust. It's readily understood, widely used in the community for this type of activity.
Right, yes. You're listening to Island Life on Waiheke Radio. I'm Jan Scott, and I'm talking to Kay Peterson, who's the chair of the Subcommittee for Headland Islands on the Gulf. Kay, have you been involved since day one?
Probably day one and a half. I was on the gallery committee at the time, and for 5 years I was chairman of the gallery, so I understand both businesses inside out and upside down. Yes, it's sometimes hard to believe that 10 years has passed and five events, but there are a couple of others who've been there that long as well.
So where did the idea come from?
Well, at the time that the idea arose, the gallery was on quite a growth spurt. There had been a number of new initiatives. There was the Walker and Hall Art Award, which I think at the time was the Goldwater Art Award, which was for two-dimensional work. There was the Waiheke Ceramic Award that I was associated with, and that still carries on in a form, slightly different. And so there was a desire to have a three-dimensional award-type exhibition. And when the three founding benefactors approached us with their idea, it was a very good fit for us. It was something that we were looking for at the time. And so away we went, really.
Right. Did you have difficulty finding the right place to put it? Or was that part of the group that came to you?
No. And we didn't have any difficulty finding the right place to put it. I mean, we are really blessed with the Matiatia walkway. It's fantastic. There isn't another site anywhere, I think, in New Zealand which would equal that. And of course, it's very close to the Fuller's Ferry Terminal, perfect for all those visitors who are coming off the ferry. And of course, last year we started our walk at the ferry terminal, which meant that we included a larger area and had that direct link. Probably the only downside to the Matiatia track is the difficulty of access for some of the very large works. If you look at similar events overseas where the access is much easier, you can see the advantage of that. But certainly, although we have some difficulty with access, we would, I think, not ever want to contemplate having to have the event somewhere else.
No, it would be difficult to replicate.
Oh, it's fantastic. I mean, the track on its own, the walk on the track, is worthwhile regardless of the art. It's a wonderful sight.
Mm. You mentioned earlier about the generosity of people living in that area who've allowed you to walk across their land.
Yes.
Or to have a sculpture on their land. And I guess that would be difficult if that sort of if the property changed hands and the person didn't want that to happen. It could create a difficulty for you.
Oh, yes, it could. And some of the properties have changed hands. It hasn't actually really led to any difficulties, which is fantastic. I mean, I think we have to acknowledge the contribution of the Guthries, where the opening event has been held five times now. It's a huge invasion, if you like, of 600 people onto their property for the opening event. But I think everybody just feels so good about Headland. All the volunteers, the sponsors' guests, because we do a lot of entertainment around the sponsors' guests as well. It's just a huge buzz for everybody, and I think that just builds on itself. we look at last time, we had public donations of, I think, close to $42,000 from people walking the track. It's a wonderful endorsement for all the work we've done.
Absolutely. Now, how do you find the sculptors, the sculptors who are going to do these works? How do you?
Oh, it's a quite a long process.
Put an advertisement out there for anybody who's interested.
Yes, we do. We have what
go
we call,
through a selection process.
Mm-hmm, we have what we call a call to exhibitors that goes out normally in November. So that's 2 years before the event. And the artists are required to put in quite a detailed proposal, and those are considered by a group of three selectors, different three selectors each time, and they are whittled down, if you like, from maybe 150, 170 proposals to the final number, and last time I think we had 38. So it's a long process. It happens over a 6 to 7 month period, and then those artists are asked then to make the work. One of the really significant things about Headland, and something that sets us apart from lots of or other similar exhibitions, is that all the work exhibited has to be new. So we're not asking for work that has been exhibited before. This has to be new work. And that means that we have to give the artist sufficient time to make the work after selection. And we have to also do quite a reasonable amount of support and contact with those artists over the time that they're making the work. Bearing in mind that all of those works has to be placed on an outdoor site, and inevitably that brings challenges. If you remember, some of the works are in the water, some of them are on the beach, some of them are on a cliff. As a tremendous amount of work goes into the actual placement, or first the choosing of the site and then the placement. So we have a lot of contact with the artists over that period of time. For those artists who are chosen, it is a major achievement. We're really pleased that we have managed to attract still a good mix of really established, well-known artists and very new, creative, young people, even children. That's one of our key strengths, is that we have that mix and able to maintain it. From the artist's point of view, some of them make a huge commitment to do this. The cost of making some of their work leads them, in fact, even to take a mortgage on their house. I mean, there's a big risk involved for the artists as well, and they do need our support.
Indeed. Is eligibility restricted to New Zealand residents?
No, and in fact in 2011 we did have international artists with us, and we're pleased about that. But they come under the same selection criteria, so everyone's regarded equally, and we hope that that will grow in the future. I think we're particularly looking maybe to Japan in the future for involvement, and of course Australia, which is very close, and a number of the sculptors from New Zealand who exhibit at Headland also exhibit at similar events in Australia. So that's great. It does need additional sponsorship, of course, but that's one of the areas of growth that we're really keen to pursue.
Excellent. Do you put any restrictions on, or do you set out criteria as to what the artworks have to be? Size?
No, only they have to be
design
new,
or
new, site-specific, and excellent construction. So
you don't give a theme, for instance, for a particular year?
No, we don't do that. We're not prescriptive in that way at all.
So it's entirely up to the artist's creativity.
Yes, it is.
So at what point do they actually visit the site?
Well, we encourage them to come and visit the site before they put in their submission. So normally what would happen if the call to artists goes out in November, and this time we would actually like to make it significantly earlier than that, in the following 3 months, anybody who wishes to put in a submission is encouraged to come and visit the site with one of our staff, so that they can walk over it and really consider the site-specific nature of their work. Some of them are not able to come, and we offer them video links and some photos assistance to do that, but it's far better if they can actually come and visit in person. So that takes up quite a lot of our time, as you can imagine. With if 150 people are going to put in a submission, that's quite a lot of time involved. But the success of the event, as it happens on January the 25th or whatever, when it opens, the success of it really goes right back through each of those steps, and each one is important in its own way. And certainly that the first visits to the site with artists is important.
And you have a certain number of sites, so it's restricted, the final selection is restricted to, was it 38 or?
Well, when we started it was 30, although we never actually got to 30 when we set 30. There always appeared to be some reason why one or two wouldn't finally eventuate. That number was set based on using the land on the walkway between what we call the Portacom site on Nick Delamore Drive and the Nick Johnson Drive, sorry, and the end. This year, because we included the hill and the foreshore to the ferry terminal, we increased the number to 40. It's governed by a number of factors. There's the space available, because you do want good separation for the work, and also it's just the sheer amount of work in dealing with that many artists and that many pieces of work. We struggled, to be honest, to cope with 38. That was a 50% increase on the event before, and the amount of increased work that meant for everybody, especially during installation, was enormous. Does cost more as well too, because the artist grant and the artist support costs us more. So I think we would be reluctant at this stage to say that we would go above that number in the foreseeable future. There is always a school of thought from visitors that more is always better. But in fact, yeah, there are sensible restrictions, and I think 40 would certainly see a cap at this time.
Right, and of course it's also the number that people can comfortably get around in a day to see them all.
Yes, and of course some are very large and some are actually not very large, so there's quite a variety. There certainly are some outstanding sites. I mean, I think we can all cast our mind back, for instance, to the work where we used the headland itself for the first time and the wall of firewood, Marcus Tatum's work there. The site-specific nature of that was fantastic. I mean, that's an iconic site. His work was very well placed there. There are others that have become iconic over the years, but there are also lots of others that we keep discovering tucked away. There'll be another site which is just perfect for a particular work.
Right.
So the sites will always change. We don't ever leave hard structure behind to reuse. So if we put in a concrete plinth, at the end of the exhibition, we have to take it out again. We have to leave the track in pristine condition. And, you know, that adds to the challenge, but it is part of the resource consent that we hold, and we do that.
Right. One other thing is, how do you select the judges?
Oh,
who does that?
Yes, you've got good questions. The selection of the selectors is actually a critical part of the whole process. Because, of course, they are making a big decision for us, and a lot rests on the quality, if you like, of their choice. We do write a brief for the selectors, so there are some guidelines for them. And we canvass a wide number of people before we choose the final three. We always look for a balance between the three. We will have a balance geographically, between different parts of New Zealand, and we'll have a balance between people from different types of institutions, because of course there are academic institutions, there are public gallery institutions, private gallery dealers, patrons, there are a number of institutions, if you like, and we try to have a balance. We also try to have a balance in terms of the selector's personal interests, and that helps us as well. So, and with a group of three, you do get a good, robust debate between the three, And that's partly why the decision or the selection process takes quite a while. So we would probably spend maybe 3 months over the process of choosing the selectors. When we approach people, they're usually thrilled to be asked, which is good from our point of view. And I think we have to acknowledge that they do make quite a significant contribution because we don't pay them for their work. And they do come to the island several times, and we can offer them good hospitality, but we're not in a position to pay them for their work. So they develop quite a close relationship with the event over the period of time as it develops. In fact, one of them last time ended up spending, I think, just about every day of the installation period actually on site helping with installation. Oh, that was a great effort.
Yes. Do you ever have an overseas judge?
No, we haven't yet, but we have considered it, and it is a possibility for the future, particularly somebody from Australia. Because there's quite close links between the art world in Australia and New Zealand.
Right. And what about, do you have people knocking on your door saying, please can I be considered to be a judge? Or do you have people approaching you?
No, that hasn't happened.
Right. That's probably a good thing.
Well, I think it would be, yes, really just, send us an email and indicate your interest, and they would be considered with everybody else. I mean, it would be fantastic if we got to that stage. Generally, these people are very busy and they're not really out there touting for work, so they're pretty committed to what they're doing already. And some of them really do headland on top of a very busy schedule.
Yes, I think it's getting to the stage where headland sculpture on the Gulf is a prestigious event, not just for the exhibitors but for the judges as well.
Yes, and I think it's one of the things that we're particularly proud of because we started with nothing, totally greenfields and high risk, and we have definitely reached the stage now where we are perceived as the most prestigious event of this type in New Zealand, probably even considered equal with anything that is exhibited in Australia. So, I mean, it's a great position for us to be in, but we don't see it stopping there. The potential to gain international recognition, which has a spin-off for every artist that exhibits with us, is fantastic.
Is there an international sort of circuit of sculpture exhibitions?
Not a circuit as such, but there is an accepted international field of exhibitions, and at this stage I think it would be fair to say that New Zealand doesn't really feature on that. But there's no reason why that has to remain so. But you have to put in the hard work, you have to build your exhibition up to that level. You can't just step in and say, hey, we're here, we're number one, or whatever. Takes a lot of hard work to get to that stage.
And, of course, part of getting to that stage is the structure of the committee and the Sculpture on the Gulf management, isn't it?
Yes, and having the right structure that attracts people to put all that time and energy into it. So, yes, that's why we're asking people to support the trust.
That's right. Now, that brings us back to one of the reasons you're here today, that there's a special meeting coming up of, is it the Art Gallery that's, members yes. of the Art Gallery that are invited to come along to a special general meeting to discuss the structure of the Art Gallery and Sculpture on the Gulf.
Yes. I mean, it's another one of those ironies, really, that the headland supporters are not actually invited to the meeting and are not able to speak at the meeting, certainly not able to vote at the meeting, because they don't automatically have gallery membership by being headland member. So we are asking any headland supporters who want to come to the meeting and speak or to vote to join the gallery committee. And that means they need to go and pay a subscription fee to be able to come.
To subscribe to the Art Gallery.
Yes.
Yep. Okay. And the option you're putting to that meeting is that the Headland Sculpture on the Gulf Committee become a trust.
Yes.
Right. And just if you'd like wouldn't mind encapsulating or summarising why that's the best option.
Well, I think we need to look at what the alternative is. The proposal which has been put forward by the gallery itself is that the galleries simply form a limited liability company to take over the assets and run the event of Headland. Now, we don't believe that that organisation or that the company structure would provide us with anything that Headland needs other than what we would see as a Clayton's degree of separation. A limited liability company which was totally owned and controlled by the gallery committee doesn't give the autonomy that Headland needs, and it would have no trust deed as a trust would, which would set in stone the terms and conditions for Headland. So a limited liability company would be totally accountable only to the gallery committee. They could change their mind at any time about the terms and conditions. Even the objectives and vision of Headland could be changed by the gallery without any further consultation. And that provides absolute insecurity for Headland in the future. So it's not a situation that we believe is good for anybody, because it's most unlikely to lead to success for Headland. It's not going to be attractive to sponsors and granting bodies. It's not going to be attractive to professionals who would otherwise be prepared to put their time and energy into it. And we don't believe that it, in fact, would be financially beneficial to the gallery anyway. So we think a limited liability company has absolutely nothing going for it. There is an argument out there about less liability for the directors of a company than for the trustees on a trust, but our legal advice is quite categoric. There is no difference in legal liability for those people. So we're yet to identify any one single advantage for the limited liability company concept, except for the gallery, which would have total control.
Right. So is the Headland Sculpture on the Gulf Committee unanimous in this decision?
Oh, yes. And we have the support of a large number of other people who've been associated with the event as well. We have sent a letter out to all Headland supporters, and all of those other people are listed on that letter. So, for instance, the last two directors of the event, many of the listeners will remember Juliet Monaghan and Dillis Grant. I mean, they're very strong supporters of the trust concept. One of the selectors from the last event, Trish Clark, who's also chair of Auckland City Public Arts, lends very, very strong support to the trust concept. Past chairman and a number of other past committee members, volunteer coordinator, sponsor coordinator, a very widespread support for a trust.
Okay. Now, the public meeting, well, it's not a public meeting, sorry, the special general meeting of the Art Gallery is going to take place on Thursday, the 30th of June, at the gallery at Artworks at 6:30 p.m. to discuss the two options.
That's
for
right.
The future.
Yes.
Is this just for the future of the Sculpture on the Gulf Committee, or is it for the gallery as well?
No, the business can only be the restructuring of Headland, because that's okay. What's on the meeting notice. I mean, I know there's discussion about other aspects of the future of the gallery as well, but this meeting won't. It's not about those.
It's purely about Headland's Sculpture on the Gulf.
Yes.
So if you're interested in that and you're not yet a member of the Art Gallery, get along there and pay your sub so that you can have your input for the future of Headland's Sculpture on the Gulf.
That's right.
Right. Thank you very much, Kay Peterson, for coming in and talking to us about Sculpture on the Gulf, and good luck for the future.
Thank you, Jan.
Very happy to say good morning to Sharon Albakery. Good morning, Sharon.
Good morning, Jan. Thank you for inviting me.
A pleasure. Now, you've come up with this wonderful idea of an emergency torch for civil emergencies, and it's got a radio that's going to be plugged into Waiheke Radio.
It is.
Great. Tell us something about it.
Well, it's quite funny, because it was actually after the February quake that I started rechecking my emergency kit, and of course I've got the usual supply of food for weeks, and masks and fire extinguishers and gas cookers and all the things that one needs, and first aid kits. And but I didn't have a transistor radio, so I went looking for a little transistor radio, and the warehouse were out. Everybody was out of them because obviously everyone had thought of the same thing. So I went online, and it was beprepared.co.nz that I got onto and saw they had this little gadget, and it was a torch and a radio plus a mobile phone charger. So I bought one and had a look at it when it arrived, and it looked fine. It was $39. So I rang the importers and asked them, would they be prepared to give us a discount of a very much cheaper price if we bought in bulk for Rotary, because I was trying to think of ways that we could raise money for Rotary. As you know, we had the horse races. Only Tangy Beach races were cancelled due to the mussels, and King of the Bay was. So we needed more money for fundraising. So it sort of fitted in there. Well, the funny thing was, I went along to Rotary to talk about my idea, and it wasn't until the following day I discovered that Placemakers actually had this exact same sort of thing, only it was a lot cheaper. And of course Lee is wonderfully supportive from Placemakers, Lee Stickland, and is passionate about the idea of everyone being prepared for in case of an emergency. So he offered to give them to us for $20 each, which meant I could sell them for $30 and raise $10 for Rotary. And it was quite funny because Bonnie Boyle, an American Rotarian who actually is a member of Rotary on Waiheke but spends a lot of time in America, she'd come to talk to us the Monday beforehand about Shelterbox, and wanted every Rotary in the world to buy one of these shelter boxes. And I won't go into describing all that because we'd be here all day. But if you Google Shelterbox, you'll see the philosophy behind it. And of course, these cost $1,500 each. And I said, well, goodness me, guys, all we need to do is sell 150 of these torches. We'll raise the money just like that, and I'll do it in a week. That was my short-term goal. So we did it. We sold 149 of these torches, and I bought the last one to make 150. So we paid for the torches and ordered them one day, collected them the next, and I've delivered most of them now to everybody who ordered them. So what my next goal is to try and do the same thing again, only sell more than double that. And the money will then stay with Rotary on Waiheke, which is very important.
That's brilliant. I must admit, I don't know whether I missed something, but until I got the email about this, I hadn't seen anything about it in the local newspapers.
Well, both of the newspapers did get behind it.
Did they? Okay. I must have missed that.
And
one.
It was
I'm
great.
Sorry about that.
No, no.
I think it's a brilliant idea.
Well, it was coincidental, as some of these things quite often are. You wonder, is it a coincidence or are we being looked after? But the day that I spoke to Rotary was actually Civil Defence Week. And it was such a great coincidence because both newspapers picked up on the story because it went with the local story. And then, of course, as soon as the article had gone in with my phone number, I put my home phone number because it makes it easier rather than having everyone driving everyone nuts at work. So my home phone number is 372-7729, and they just ring up and order them and leave their details and I ring them back. Basically people have been dropping the money into me at Bailey's, and it's easier for them to just drop it in there, and then I just go and buy the torches.
Brilliant. Now explain what these torches look like and what they do.
All right, well, what it is, it's quite a small, compact little, it would fit in your handbag, and it's a torch, an LED torch that has two types. When you turn the torch on forward, it has three LED bulbs, and when you turn the switch backwards, it has just one LED bulb. Make sure you turn it off. It's got a little alarm on it in case you're in an emergency. It's all powered exclusively by dynamo, and so it's had a little battery inside, and you wind it up and then turn on the radio. I don't think it's a good idea to turn on the radio, is it?
Probably because, not.
Because it will give feedback.
Yes,
but
it's, right.
I keep it on 88.3, which is very, very clear. And then I know it's on
which
my local.
Which, of course, is the Waiheke radio
station. Yeah. So then I know it's on that. Because I found it by because it doesn't have a dial, so it's just got a scan button. So you just press the scan button. You've got your car radio going on 88.3, and then you press the scan button until you hear the same station, and then you're on it, and then you leave it on that. Then on the other side, we have a little adapter here that takes the charger for the mobile phone. Now this has actually got two adaptions, just the two standard sizes. If you have a mobile phone that has an unusual connection, then you just go to Dick Smith or one of these electrical shops to get your own connection for your own particular mobile phone. But
So it will connect into your mobile.
Well, it charges when you wind up the handle. Right. See the phone says it's charging.
So it charges the phone. Wow,
yes.
Isn't that amazing?
So it's perfect. Yeah.
Do we have an idea of how long the battery lasts?
Well, as long as you, it's a good question, Jan, because I tell everyone who buys them, as long as you don't put it away with the radio going, because if you actually leave the radio going and it drains the battery completely, then you can't recharge it. So. But the torch would still work. The thing is, with this, you make sure you turn the radio off. When you're hearing the volume going down a bit, that's when you start charging it up again. But basically, mm-hmm. It's for an emergency. You wouldn't use it probably every day unless you wanted to, but it's it doesn't give you any shelf life. We have nothing. It doesn't say there how long it would last, but I would imagine being dynamo, like our lights on our bicycles, they go forever if you just keep on charging them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great idea. Now, you mentioned earlier, Sharon, that you've programmed your radio to 88.3 FM,
yes.
Which is one of Island Waiheke Radio's channels. The other one, if you're in a different area on Waiheke, you might find it's clearer on 107.4 FM.
I haven't tried that one, but I was going to actually try that to see if that one was as clear. But 88.3 is brilliant. It's lovely and clear. So.
Excellent. And, of course, we've got ourselves organised now with the Civil Defence Link, and used it first time for the tsunami warning, when that big tsunami in Japan.
Yes.
For the swells on
that's right
round the island and that sort of thing.
Well, so, I was very impressed with Waiheke Radio because they, off their own bat, saw the article in the paper and produced a flyer for me talking about our local radio. And at the bottom, they had Rotary's logo, and it was beautifully presented. And so I've photocopied those off. Thanks to my boss, Mary Kuhnau at Bailey's, was very happy to let me photocopy off one for everyone who takes a torch and so that they can read all about it. So that's great.
Absolutely. That's brilliant. Now, you're still selling these?
I want to sell as many as possible. My goal is to have every household having one. So we're thinking of ways to promote them. And if anyone's got any great brainstorming ideas, I'd really appreciate it if they wanted to ring me. We are having a car boot sale. Tony Moss from Food Emporium has generously said he will organise a car boot sale for Rotary, because Rotary do so much on the island and we definitely need the funds. Mm. And these two major fundraisers haven't gone ahead. So we do need funds all the time. So I'm going to have a store in that car boot sale where I'll be selling these. And the great thing is $10 for every torch goes towards Rotary. And
that's
it's marvellous.
How long have you been involved in Rotary?
Oh, only a couple of years. I got asked to help with the silent auction at the beach races and got really wholeheartedly involved and have been in there ever since. I love it. It's a wonderful thing to do because you see behind the scenes all the fellowship that goes on and wonderful things that they do for people that most people never hear about.
Exactly. It's only really the big items that you hear Rotary getting involved
or
given the publicity.
That's correct. But they do so much behind the scenes, and they don't advertise what they do, but it's incredible what happens within our little community. And this is what I was so thrilled about, that I had this idea. I thought, wouldn't it be great? I have a short-term goal. I announced my goal. I told everyone how close I was to the goal, and within a week I'd reached that goal, just because it's Waiheke. And we're going to now carry on trying to get them in schools, trying to get everyone behind it. So if you can think of great ideas, I'd love to.
Well, there's a challenge for everybody out there. If you can think of a great idea to promote these wonderful torches. And just looking at it, I mean, it's a lovely bright yellow, so you won't miss it. Are they all the same colour?
Yes, they're all the same colour. And the good thing is, too, before I got involved with this, I wanted to check sustainability of supply. So Lee was very careful about that and checked with head office that there is a non-stop supply of these, and so we won't run out of stock.
That's great. And we've got to give thanks to Lee Stickland,
yes,
at
Placemakers. He's very generous.
For that sponsorship, which is virtually what it is, isn't it?
It's a great sponsorship.
So, yeah. Now, what about, let me see, where are we now? We're at June. We're well over halfway through the year. It's wintertime coming up, but hey, you could get in early for Christmas shopping.
Well, that's what a lot of people have done. They've put them in their cupboard for Christmas presents for the grandchildren. But for elderly people, they'd love to have one as well. And quite often you think, oh, what can I get Grandma, because she's got everything. Most things, and you just usually get a cake of soap and something, you know, rattle around the brain. But if you can give one of those to people when they're, and especially like children's birthday parties where you have to take a present to a child, oh, this is just perfect idea. And we're also helping our own community. So even if we can sell them off island to other things, we're raising the money for our community. Which is what we want to do.
And it all goes back into Waiheke community, as you say.
Yes, that's right.
What's your involvement with Rotary?
Oh, my job is to actually help Rick Colmer organise the speakers. So if anyone has any ideas of great speakers, I'd love to hear about them as well, because I'm always trying to bail people up on the ferry and ask them if they'll talk at Rotary about whatever they're interested in, anything they're passionate about, anything that they want more people to know about, like Bonnie Boyle coming along, talking about the shelter box. We knew nothing about it, even though it's been going for 11 years. I was totally unaware about it. And that shelter box has got a 10-man tent, cooking facilities, a little, it's got the water purifier, the thermal blankets, the mozzie nets. It comes with a team of people. It's not just one box, because people need to know how to work the contents inside. And quite often in disasters, these people don't even read English or don't understand instructions. And so they've, at the moment, I looked on the website this morning, and Shelterbox, www.shelterbox.co, or just Google it. I think it's .co.nz. But when I looked today, as of today, there's over 106,000 of these shelter boxes that have been purchased, and they're helping people all over the world in the most major disasters.
Sounds like a great idea, actually.
Well,
even,
I mean, it's
even
all
though they're so expensive, but
yes,
you can
yes.
understand why.
Well, it's
with
a
all
team of men going in as well, or trained people, I should say. But the thing is, when you are in a disaster and you do get given food, like rice or whatever, and you can't cook it and you don't have shelter, it can actually not even help you. So this is where you've got the shelter. But it's the 10-man tent was designed to last for, you know, just give shelter for about 6 months, because it's hurricane-proof. But they've gone back 3 years later and families are still living in these. So they're very, very sturdy.
Yes, I wonder if they've used some done in Christchurch.
No. The wonderful thing is, we don't need this in New Zealand. Bonnie was saying how every time we have a disaster in New Zealand, we all open our homes. And that's what we did last time. We had people coming to Waiheke and staying. Mm. And everyone who has cookers will take people into their house and let them stay. And we've never ever needed anything, I don't think, in New Zealand anywhere. I can't imagine us ever needing it here in New Zealand, but they've certainly used them in Australia. And when you have a look on the website, you'll see they've used them all over the world, and particularly in America with these latest disasters they've had over there. So,
Yes, no, that sounds like a great idea. Now, how often do you have speakers at
Every Rotary? Monday night. We meet on a Monday night at the bowling club, and every Monday night we have a speaker, but on the first Monday of the month. It's usually a club speaker because that's when we have committee meetings to work out our plans, what we're doing.
Right.
All the different committees.
Rotary is by invitation, is it?
Or? No, we would love new members. We're always on the lookout for new members. I think I don't know what sort of criteria you need to have to belong. It's just obviously you need to be able to dedicate time and money for causes, for helping people. So we're always on the lookout for people with high energy and who have been very successful in their businesses so that they can help us be successful with our fundraising and with our organising of the finance.
Mm. Yes, of course, that's an ongoing problem, isn't it?
Being
a voluntary organisation.
It is. Mm.
Yeah,
mm.
And not just for Waiheke.
No, it's always.
But as you say, we had a double whammy this year with the mussel shells on.
Mm. Yeah, it's very sad.
On Onitangi Beach, and that must have been a huge hit financially for you.
Yes, well, $20,000 was raised at the last beach races. I'd spent personally months collecting things for the silent auction, and the businesses on Waiheke are very generous, and I very rarely ever have anyone say no when I ask them for something. And I had collected a huge amount of things for the beach races, and I was dreadfully disappointed. But the wonderful thing is the people who have donated, particularly vineyards and all things that products that don't go off and don't have go past their sell date, they've actually been quite happy to say, look, just keep the wine that you've got or keep the gifts that you've got and use them at the next fundraising. So we are having a big fundraiser in August, which will be a casino evening run professionally by professional casino. Ian Hastings is wonderful. He's getting it all sorted at the school, so you'll hear more about that later on.
Absolutely. Now, you mentioned earlier about a car boot sale.
Yes.
Done by the Food Embassy at
Ostend. This is all in the.
Do you know when that is happening?
It's all in the melting pot at the moment. I think it will probably be the 17th of July, but we'll just wait and see nearer the time because I'm not on the.
Right.
Organising committee of that one.
No, fine, but you will have these wonderful torches available.
Yes, I will, yes.
Now, we'll just go backtrack on the torches. They are the size of an ordinary torch, I think. Not huge.
I think in inches, and so I think it's probably about, what would that be, 6 inches probably.
Yeah.
Yes, it's very easily held in the palm of your hand, yes.
Yeah, that's right. And they are LED, which is
LED.
A very bright light.
It is,
yes. It's a wonderful bright light. Mm. And run by a dynamo.
You just wind
it up to keep it charged.
Yes.
And one of the best parts of it, it's got a little radio on it.
Yes.
That you can program
tune
to Waiheke Radio.
That's
which, because we do have, if there is an emergency, then we will be having regular bulletins on that. And therefore, if you've got one of these torches, tune it into either 88.3 FM or 107.4 FM, depending on whereabouts in the island you are, you'll soon suss out which is the better reception. And it's also got an alarm on it, hasn't it?
Yes, the alarm. Do you want to hear it again?
Oh, love to.
Woo.
Oh, isn't that great?
It's actually quite loud. So if you were in trouble, like at home and perhaps having a heart attack, it would be quite quick to just press that. And
Just in ordinary circumstances, if you're walking down the road at night time somebody jumps out at you or something, just push the button on that and scare them away.
It would actually make quite a nice little weapon because you could whack someone and press the button at the same time.
I suppose so. I don't think we'll promote that one.
No. Well, only if you need to. Only if you need to protect yourself. That's funny.
As a last resort.
Yeah, yes.
Last resort. How much are you selling them for?
I'm selling them for $30, and every torch, every $30, $10 goes to Rotary.
And you can buy them from Sharon?
Yes, you can buy them from me. So the best way to save chaos at work is to just call my home number, 372-7729, and I will tell you how to organise paying for them and how to organise collecting them from me. So
that'd be great. And also, if you've got any bright ideas, pardon the pun, of how these things can be promoted, or if you've got any ideas to help Sharon do the roster for the speakers to the weekly Rotary Club meetings, give her a call. Thank you very much, Sharon, for coming
in. Thank you, Jan. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the interviews from last Saturday's Island Life, our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. Island Life is brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, and the interviews are replayed on Wednesdays at 7 o'clock. They're also available as a download from our website, www.waihekeradio.org.nz. Island Life is brought to you by Island, the shop with Waiheke's most eclectic collection of local art, craft, giftware, clothing and bric-a-brac. Island, Ocean View Road, Onirua.